I'm out here trying to not get murdered, okay?
This is Off Baseline. I'm Nate Staley. This week I talk with Stephen Robbins, immigration attorney out of Washington State and host of an excellent podcast that I highly recommend, Redirect: Immigration Law and Perspectives. Check it out on Apple Podcasts or on patreon.com/redirect. They have a membership level where you can donate to the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project, which is a pretty cool thing to do with Patreon. And he's not the biggest self-promoter, from what I have picked up. So check that out. In what follows, we look at some general misconceptions and attitudes about immigration that sort of make debate on this topic fruitless and unproductive. We look at how not just policy, but if who is enforcing that policy makes a difference. And we look at the mental health impact of a dysfunctional immigration system on people whose lives depend on it. We ask such questions as, are immigrants welfare freeloaders? Are immigrants going to murder you and your family unless the guy getting sued by a porn star built a big, beautiful see-through wall? How does Stephen cope with this super depressing world that we live in? All this and more after I briefly say that if this is your first time or maybe your seventh time listening, thanks for doing that. I appreciate it a lot. If you want to support, head on over to iTunes or Apple Podcasts or whatever the kids are calling it these days. And you might be, at the time of recording anyway, the first review. So that's always fun to get the first review. So do I want you to leave an iTunes review? That'd be great. Will it happen? Can't say. Is this introduction over? Sure hope so. Is it a testament to the individual? Too soon to tell. Interview coming up. Stephen Robbins. Check it out. Joining me on Off Baseline is Stephen Robbins, an immigration lawyer from my childhood home state of Washington, and host of the podcast Redirect: Immigration Law and Perspectives. Stephen, thanks for coming on the show.
You're from Washington?
Yeah.
What part?
I grew up in Cedar Woolley.
Never heard of it.
Skagit Valley.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Kind of over, close to Canada.
Liberal elite.
Yeah, I was a Southern Baptist preacher's kid, which is the perfect demographic to to jump into liberal elitism.
Yeah, there you go. In Washington, there's, the West Side.
Yes, and then there's where all the civilized people are, yeah.
Well, I live on the East Side, so how dare you?
Yeah, yeah.
First of all.
You live in, am I allowed to say that, first of all? I know you, from your practice and everything, like where you live. I guess you talk about it, but.
Yeah, I'm in Central Washington.
Okay, yeah, so you're in the greater Central Washington area.
This is a geography show, right?
Did yeah, you say? It's about geography. You caught that.
Okay, good. I'm on fire then.
Cool. I'm honored. Yeah, you knew exactly what the show is about. So I guess I could have also introduced you as Ronald Reagan, legendary caller in of the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. Which is how I became familiar with your work, as you call in frequently to provide perspectives on the ever-changing topic of immigration from the front lines.
Yep. Yeah, that's
a thing you do.
That's a thing I do. Yeah, for sure.
Right on. So I appreciate the chance to speak with you on my humble podcast, because I think the gap between the impact of immigration policy on the health of a society, and so between that and the level of accurate facts within the public discourse on the topic, is so vast that it's really a problem and worth addressing on as many platforms as possible.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. I think I've been practicing immigration law for about 7 years, and I remember last year having a moment where I like the impact that this has on children specifically really hit home in a way that it hadn't before. And even though that's like a huge focus of my practice, like not just that there's kids and things happen to them, but we're often specifically addressing the hardship to the kids. And yet, you know, I'm still learning about how these policies and practices can impact, I think, especially the children. Yeah, like you said, the society as a whole, for sure.
Well, it's just so much more impactful when you see, you know, just I guess from the human experience of seeing children suffering, sometimes really emphasizes and highlights things that are unjust or immoral that are going on. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always tell the story about how, you know, my family was very middle class. My dad was a blue collar, you know, he was an industrial electrician, and we were never rich. We rode around in a nasty 72 Oldsmobile station wagon. It was like this really disgusting orange color, which now I think would be awesome, but at the time it was shameful.
Oh, that's cool. We had an 89 Buick LeSabre, I remember. But
yeah, same sort of thing. Did you have the backwards facing row in the, at the back? Or
oh no, we did. We weren't fortunate enough.
Okay, yeah. Those were cool.
They were. Anyhow, they were. I dreamed of them.
Yeah, every kid wanted to be in that backwards facing last row. But anyhow,
yeah.
My dad lost his job in, I don't know, probably 93 or 94. And I would have been in middle school, I think, or maybe fifth grade. Anyhow, it was this huge cloud over everything that was happening to me at that time that we might have to move.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The move was going to be probably to like another city within the United States of America, probably within the same state.
Right.
Which now looking back is like, not a big deal, but at the time it was. Yeah. And so then I compare that and how it felt at the time to these kids who don't know for sure that mom and dad will be there when they get home from school, or don't know for sure, depending on how this court turns out in April or May or whenever, you know, maybe we're going to have to pack up and move to a country where if you get online and you do any reading at all, you find out it's, you know, a murderous hellhole of one sort of the, or another. And I don't know that my middle school brain could have begun to to handle that level of stress if I was freaking out just about a move.
Probably wouldn't have been able to, because the middle school brain is very very focused on a small area if you have the ability to do that. You know, if you're not you know, in the American middle schooler, probably the sphere of their world is pretty small, or at least maybe it's just autobiographical, but that's definitely been you know, so just to comprehend having to just completely give up all the structure and support and everything, you know, the stability that you had, and go to a place that you've never known, but people say that you belong to.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly.
So I did want to, so while I have you on the show, I wanted to clear up, maybe give you kind of an opportunity to share some of like, common misconceptions, about what you do or about immigration law more broadly.
Well, I guess what I would say, because we don't have all night long, I would say if you get on an average comment thread or somebody says something on Facebook about immigration law, it's basically going to be wrong.
Generally, yes.
Period.
Just anything you read.
Yeah. Even, you know, some articles and things try really hard to get it right. And sometimes there's you know, partial truths, but varying shades of truthiness. And so it becomes really hard to have a debate about the issue when everyone's starting from a different reality. And so it becomes basically impossible to have. Like, I noticed, I actually met with somebody from the local comments section. This guy's like notorious on the local paper Facebook page and on the comment section of the newspaper. And I was like, I want to meet you.
Nice.
And so we got coffee and
that's pretty brave.
Yeah, I didn't get murdered, which is the good news. And then that was the whole takeaway. I found that we were able to basically, like, if I said, you know, wouldn't it be great if there was a system that, like, you know, let people get in line and prove that they're a good person and prove that they contribute to society and subject themselves to background checks. And, you know, wouldn't that be, you know, sort of like how we would want to do it. And people, even really conservative people, are kind of like, yeah, you know, that's what we would want to have, or that's what I want you to think. They kind of imagine that that's how it already works. Right. They talk about get to the back of the line.
Right. That's how it worked before Obama screwed it all up.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You know, why didn't you hear this about the dream? Well, you've been here, you know, 20 years, why didn't you apply for your citizenship? And it's like, nothing that you just said makes any sense. And so that's what's so frustrating, is I can sit down with like a fairly radical right-wing person and agree on the outlines of what an immigration system could look like or should look like.
Sure.
And then they'll immediately fall back to, you know, but we got to build a wall and we got to, you know, if you're an illegal, and it's,
right.
Yeah, it's maddening.
It's because we care that we want to, you know, build a wall and deport people. And yeah, I guess, I don't know.
Yeah. And it's also frustrating because it's not like, you know, if I've got an old truck, which I love, but I also don't know that much about old trucks. Right.
Yeah.
So it's,
you definitely,
like,
need one in Central Washington.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm out here trying to not get murdered. Okay. So
yeah, that's the rule number one.
I got myself an old pickup, right?
Right.
And I'm on like a Facebook group for people with old Ford trucks. And first of all, these are like the meanest people in the world, but it would be really weird for me to go on there and be like, actually the 351W has more horsepower than the 451 or whatever. I'm just saying numbers.
You're delving into the world of knowing things about trucks.
And to have like this army of mechanics and people who like live and breathe this stuff come down and say, let us teach you a thing about how these engines work. And for me to still be like
defiant in that,
fuck you guys.
Yeah.
You're wrong.
Right.
You know, some douchebag on YouTube told me that this is how these motors work, and I'm going to disregard all your expertise. And that's also another thing that's frustrating about this, is being a, you know, quote unquote expert. I'm not really an expert, but it's like literally my profession. And I can walk people through this in a calm and rational way. And at the end, they'll just repeat the dumb thing they said at the beginning.
Yeah. So does it feel like they weren't listening all along, or there's some sort of suspended, like this lack of trust where I can't actually take what you just told me and synthesize that right here? I've got to go check my sources, or what do you think's going on with that? I mean, pretty intense societal analysis, but
yeah. So as somebody who, it feels a little, so I grew up in a pretty orthodox religious environment, and that feels a little bit like talking to somebody about their faith. And there's a wall that you can put up to where you have things in your psyche that are just walled off from criticism.
Yeah.
And you will sort of protect those things mm-hmm. no matter what.
Right.
And so
key doctrine.
It feels a little bit like views or perspectives on immigration are in that little category for a lot of people. And so just a quick example, I've got an uncle on Facebook who he was saying that, you know, people are undocumented because they don't love America. And the proof of that is that if they loved America, they'd go to the citizenship store and buy their citizenship like everybody else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, this thread on Facebook is like 3 feet long, you know, back and forth, and it stays civil. And I'm explaining, like, here's all the reasons why you're exactly wrong.
Yeah,
and then
you can't
at
just
the
find
end
a booth in Walmart.
Right, exactly. You know, these are the things specifically that prohibit somebody from applying for legal status. And then at the very end, after all this, I feel like I've, you know, given my dissertation. He says, well, you know, if they really love this country, I think they would do it. You're saying it's hard. You're saying it's hard. But, you know, if you love America, you're going to be willing to do hard things.
Yeah, you gotta. That's true sacrifice. So, yeah, like you did. Like we all did hard things to be born here. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Wasn't easy.
No, so. It just, you know, not anyone can make it out like that.
Right, exactly.
Of their mom. Yeah.
Right. So many opportunities there for... things that we should, yeah, let's move
right.
on.
So totally. Yeah. So anyway, being sensitive and to, again, you know, specifics, and I understand, you know, I appreciate, client privilege as a therapist, I can really appreciate that. But as there are some mental health issues that can be probably made worse by our system of immigration, you know, like, anxiety, PTSD, depression. So the clients, having to juggle everything already with this mess of a system and then having to deal with that. In what ways have you noticed that system, adversely impacting clients' mental health?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I've got a client right now who's detained with schizophrenia. That's an almost too obvious example. He's been locked up for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. And one thing that's extremely difficult, so I'm told, about immigration detention is the indefiniteness of it. So this is how it's been explained to me. I've also done hard time, so I totally get it. But
let's spread that. Yeah. Stephen, your audio is breaking up a little bit.
Did I fix it?
Still kind of bad.
Okay.
Better. I can hear words better now. So yeah, that's an improvement.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm literally sitting on my bed. So let's say
you
get locked up.
Why is your
up.
Bed moving?
Yeah. So you get locked up and you get 5 years. And you know you're going to get out in 5 years. And there's something about having, you know, that knowledge makes it tolerable, I guess. Mm-hmm. But if you're in immigration detention, and let's say you lose and you appeal, and you ask your lawyer, like, how long will the appeal take? And we say, well, we don't know. Like, maybe 6 months, and then the case will come back here, and then that will take maybe another 6 months, but we don't really know, and we don't know if you're even going to win, so you could get released here, or you might get released abroad. And the sort of uncertainty of it, I think psychologically is really hard.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is when people are in the process of it, I mean, I'm not a doctor scientist, but obviously, you know, stress levels are high. People can be irritable, all those things. But one thing I have noticed is on the back end, the change that we see when people, you know, get papers and maybe I see them like a year later at the grocery store and I pull up in my pickup and they're in their pickup. Run into each other and there's something different about them. There's something, you know, they seem more, relaxed, more confident. Mm-hmm. That's a real thing, I think. Yeah. And yeah,
just as far as the impact of the acute situational stress, that can kind of change how you, you know, like your whole being, your whole, how you carry yourself.
Right.
And
exactly.
Knowing an outcome can drastically, you know, it can drastically improve that.
Right. Yeah. So it's, I think just the uncertainty of the day to day, even when people have, you know, good cases and, mm-hmm. you know, you've got a way to, we're going to get through this, we're going to fix it. Even when people have some confidence in that, not knowing from day to day, like, am I going to get arrested? Am I going to be detained?
Right.
And it used to be under the Obama administration, we could give certain people some degree of assurances, like you're not a priority. You won't be targeted unless you get arrested. And now we can't really do that. And so that makes it harder too, because a couple of years ago, you know, I might have been able to sit down with somebody and say, look, you know, you've got a clean record, you've got an application pending, and everything's going to be fine, just stay out of trouble. And now it's sort of like, yeah, I also hope you don't get arrested.
As your attorney, I have the same hopes as you.
I'm also crossing my fingers.
And that's the best I can do. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways.
Yeah. No, that's crazy. Just to that's gotta be, from even just a professional standpoint, that's gotta be kind of hopeless and beyond frustrating.
It's been hard. I think the shift from, there's a certain category of people who are subject to removal, but they had discretion exercised in their favor under the Obama administration.
Right.
And that category of people are now at the highest risk, because if they're mm-hmm. arrested and the discretion is pulled out from under them, they have no other relief. There's
right.
no other options. And so I think especially for that category of people, and you see those are usually the types of stories you see in the news of, oh, this guy's been here forever and now he's being deported. Usually those are the types of people who, you know, they went through some process some years ago and ultimately they were allowed to stay mm-hmm. as a favorable act of discretion. And now they're being kicked out.
Now
so for those people, I think
those.
Right now, the government's saying, well, you've got a removal order. We don't really care that you've got some kid with mm-hmm. a condition. We're going to execute the order.
Right. We're going to do it even more so just because we need to look tough.
And in fact, like I remember last year I had a young dreamer on my podcast and, we did an interview right after the election. And then a couple months later, she called me and was like, can you take it down? Like, I don't want to be out there. And I thought, well, she's being paranoid. This mm-hmm. is weird. And then, you know, in the last few months we've seen, oh no, actually I was being naive.
Sure.
And she was being savvy because in fact, activists are being arrested and placed in removal proceedings. Mm-hmm. On the basis of the fact that they're activists. So
yeah, they're being targeted specifically.
Right. And I think because they make louder stories and they can be made examples of, yeah. So,
and maybe perhaps a function of that too, is the fact that, this is just me picking up from some of the things you've been sharing, whether it's on your show, but the, how the courts are just all tied up right now. And so they can't possibly get the numbers of deportations that maybe they're hoping for. So, maybe having this aggressive kind of terror campaign, you know, will, help them be more effective. Is that a fair way to put that?
Yeah, I think that that's definitely, to some degree, you know, part of it. You know, they want to be in the newspaper, mm-hmm. they want to make it seem like, you know, they're doing big, important things. I definitely,
right. I bet just for lack of being able to achieve their, as much immediate results as they can, terror can really go a long way.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Mitt Romney immigration plan, which was, right. You know, we're not going to physically deport them all, but we're going to make their lives so miserable that they're going to want to leave on their own. And so if you can get people to live in constant fear and anxiety and uncertainty, then you will, in fact, lose some percentage of the people via self-deportation. It's not a huge number, but some people will say, you know, okay, so I might get locked up for 3 or 4 months, even though I never did anything wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get out of here. This is not right. So,
you're saying there possibly are consequences for who's in office, even though you might be cynical about, about the differences between the major political parties.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you go back and listen to my show, we were really critical of Hillary Clinton too, because I think there's plenty to be critical of. And if she were president now, we'd have all kinds of immigration related complaints, I'm sure. But there were under Obama, relatively.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. And so, and in fact, not just, hey, you know, Obama, I think you could be nicer around the edges. He had some really terrible, truly terrible policies, but, there's always room to be worse. And in fact, just today, Jeff Sessions, he's allowed to cherry pick these cases that are in the immigration appeals process to issue decisions himself. So there's a board of immigration appeals. They decide these cases, and he, under the law, is allowed to say, you know what, I'm going to issue the decision. I'm going to issue a controlling decision, a precedent in this case. And he just picked his fourth immigration case, and all these cases that he's going to end up deciding on are cases where he's going to be able to screw over, you know, huge numbers of immigrants and strip them of their rights without Congress passing a law or without anything like that. And so, yeah, of course.
It's crazy. It just feels completely, you know, the extra judicial kind of power that you can assert from that office to just tear apart families. And, you know, we're seeing the effectiveness of the power of that office there.
Right. Yeah. And, it's cruel, you know, but it's also, you know, he's a guy who, Martin Luther King Jr.'s widow wrote a letter about him specifically and how he's a terrible racist. So
he has, this isn't his first, rodeo with, being awful to, non-white people.
Right. Yeah. So, his bona fides, his racist bona fides are strong. And so,
They're up there. I'll give them that.
Right.
Yeah. So I want to be respectful of your time and just maybe have a question or so more, but,
sure.
So I want to ask kind of specifically about, programs. So a common complaint, that you might hear from, say, a Trump supporter or perhaps an equally misinformed liberal person is that illegal immigrants are draining social welfare programs like Social Security, Medicaid, food stamps, you know, et cetera, while not contributing anything back into society. They're not paying taxes, or they're not doing this, or they're not doing that. Are these claims accurate on any level?
I would say no. So in the first place,
the first point,
If you're undocumented, you don't have access to the social safety net. You can't get food stamps. You can't get cash assistance. You can get some of those things for your U.S. citizen children, but not for yourself. And so that's not true. They pay billions of dollars with a B into Social Security and Medicare, and they don't get any of those benefits back. So they're paying literally my retirement.
It's through payroll tax and sales tax, right?
Right, exactly. And the vast majority of them do file taxes. A lot of them that don't file taxes don't earn enough to require the filing of a tax return. And on top of that, a lot of them, for example, we live in an agricultural area. It's not like if you go into an apple orchard, there's going to be one or two undocumented people or immigrants,
right,
documented or undocumented. It's going to be all. I mean,
the whole economy of that small town often can.
And it's not a small economy. I mean, every year I always laugh because every year there's a couple of articles in the Yakima Herald about, you know, this is going to be the biggest cherry season ever. And it's, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions, sometimes billions of dollars in expected revenue.
Right.
And
in capitalist terms, they're like some extreme production and productivity happening there.
Right. And then I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, people are people, and we shouldn't have to put them on some sort of scale to determine how worthy they are to exist. In general, our goal should be to be more empathetic, to try and understand, you know, what are the conditions that led to this person coming here? And right. It is interesting as an attorney to be able to sit down with somebody that if you saw them on the street, they would just be a Mexican guy or, you know, a person. And then to find out that in almost every case of somebody who's undocumented, there's some sort of early trauma, and they don't even recognize it as trauma. But again, comparing it to my stupid middle school life, I mean, almost always it's, I had to drop out of school in fifth grade or sixth grade, or sometimes there were no schools in my town.
Right.
We just had to work. And even though I was working from the time I was 12, we didn't earn enough to eat. And so when I was 17 or 14, I came to the United States out of like pure necessity.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people had to forge documents so that they'd be old enough to get, so it would look like they were old enough to get like the shittiest jobs that we have to offer. And then to hear people say, well, you know, they're lazy or they don't work hard,
right.
To have no empathy for this person who was born into, you know, sometimes the most complicated and sometimes disturbing circumstances, but somehow managed to fight their way out of it and to build a life for themselves and their family. Yeah. That's a total lack of empathy on our part as a society and as a culture. And that's what needs to change, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a great point and a great image for us to think about as we've flipped that narrative. This potentially beautiful story of, despite all odds, you know, thriving and coming out of extreme poverty and extreme traumatic circumstances, children having to, you know, be kind of like hold their families together and to not really have any kind of a life just to live as children and to develop kind of normally, just all those things, like to come from that. And, you know, it's pretty amazing and we should be celebrating it. Instead, we're demonizing and, you know, and demagoguing. And the heartbreaking thing from my perspective is a lot of people I care about are doing that. Are doing, you know, the demonizing and the demagoguing and just kind of buying into this narrative. And it, you know, and people, from that have similar like faith backgrounds and worldviews that I share, that you know, it's nauseating when we have discussions about this topic. And you know, especially around election time a couple of years back, it was just it was so frustrating that I just couldn't really communicate after a certain point. I just there was just this exhaustion and this shock that set in. But yeah, we really are just discounting, you know, a potentially great story.
Right. And it's disturbing to hear things that are literal. Like when Trump announced this this hotline for reporting immigrant crimes.
Voice.
Yeah. And they were going to publish them. It's like, oh, this is a literal Nazi thing. Like, this is not Trump is like a Nazi because I don't like his hair or some political hyperbole. Yeah. I like Hillary, so Trump is a Nazi. No, right. This is like this is the Gestapo or whatever. This is a thing that they literally did.
It was, yeah, it, right.
And that's when it goes from being sort of sad and distraught to
surreal,
borderline surreal and freaking out. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, during the State of the Union, just hearing him just describe that, it was like I had, I don't know, stepped into a documentary or a movie or something. It was just,
bizarre.
Yeah. It was an angle of fear about, like, you know, the nation that I lived in, that I had not experienced yet.
Yeah. But I think also, you know, as a white guy who grew up in a white area, like the only, person of color at our school was a Filipino, one Filipino, I think, you know, and then a sea of white kids. I was totally divorced from the experience of Black America. Mm-hmm. And when you heard, and the thing I realized with this election is when you hear people say, this isn't my country, this isn't the country I know. It's like, no, this, it is. Right. You never saw it. You never saw it before, but it was always there.
Right.
Right. And so for people like
the country
me,
was built on that, really. Yeah.
Right. Are you going to sit there and pretend like slavery never happened, or you know, any of these many,
or that it was fixed?
Right. Yeah, exactly. So in that way, not that any of this is good, but I do think, if you know, at least for me personally, not that I was unaware of our terrible history before, but to be able to sit back and go like, oh, okay, that panic and that worry that I'm feeling now is what people of color have felt for centuries.
Yeah. Yeah. You're late to this party.
But worse. Like, not to compare,
like, way worse. Yeah.
Not to for a second compare my, like, ooh, Trump seems dangerous to,
so I've,
you know, maybe I'll be lynched. Those are totally different things. But
what was, like, that James Damore quote, like being gay in the 1950s or something?
Right. Yeah. Him getting fired from Google.
Right. You know, yeah. Yeah.
Really gave him insight into
the utmost perspective. Yeah.
Right.
Brave, brave person.
I shouldn't have said that. It sounded like I was equating the two things. I'm not.
No. But, and so, what really kind of how I was interpreting that was, we're all trying to develop empathy in of this situation that, well, so I work when I do therapy, I see a lot of situations coming from some abject poverty in community mental health that I have the slightest clue how to wrap my mind around, or to even be homeless in the middle of winter and, miss the cutoff time for getting into the homeless shelter, for that day. Those kinds of things. It's really hard. I mean, and you're supposed to, literally, that's my job. I'm supposed to have empathy, and it's really hard to, because, those severe traumatic experiences, coming from the privilege that we do, it's just super hard to do that. So you have to be honest about where you're coming from and your limited perspective, but it is okay to try to, I think anyway, try to, say, okay, this is the suffering that maybe I'm aware of, and then like quadruple that. And, maybe that's what, or, even more like that's what they're going through, or that might be what they're going through.
Right. Yeah.
So I appreciate that. When the voice thing, during the State of the Union, that was just that whole speech, that whole thing. It was just kind of curling up in the fetal position as I was listening to it, to be honest, but maybe that's TMI.
No,
but I think a lot of us were. So we're coming up on sort of the end of, I'm going to be respectful of your time. And so, I appreciate you coming on. And, before I can let you go, the off baseline interview process is sort of an authoritarian regime where the discussion of coping skills or methods of self-care is mandatory for every guest I invite on, knowingly, or otherwise. So in order for you to fulfill your surprise obligations, are there any things that you do to cope with the particularly heavy burden of the work that you do, the draining uphill nature of your job, or of following the news generally?
So last year after the inauguration, I was getting really depressed. Everything was so depressing. And I started to notice, if I exercise, I would suddenly not want to kill myself right in that moment.
Yeah.
And so I kind of bit the bullet and started paying for, a physical trainer and working out during the day, close to my office. And it's more expensive than I would like to pay, than I would like to pay.
Yeah, they always
but I just, right. I just got to the point where I was like, this has to be, I'm busy and I've got other things going on, but I have to make this a priority.
Mm-hmm.
I also have weird hobbies like scale model building. So cool. I like to go in the garage and put together plastic model kits like a dork. And
hey, dorks have some of the best coping skills.
There's just something about it. It's you're just following instructions and
just kind of shut off and delve into that world.
Yep. So that's what I would say.
Right on. I look up urban planning and city transportation and stuff like that. Yeah. That's my dorky thing that I do.
That's a good idea. I'll have to try that.
It's a wonderful, it really just helps to get rid of all the depression and anxiety.
Right.
So yeah, so okay, awesome. So you do so physical activity, that's a great way to you know, just relieve that stress, get those, get the release the you know, the endorphins, and put you in a better mental health state as well as a physical health state. And yeah, that's really good. Thanks for sharing that. You've fulfilled your mandatory obligations.
Nice. Right on. Well, yeah. I'm going to go play with my baby now. That's another thing I do. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Playing with a baby is a good coping skill, too. I've got a 1.5-year-old, so it's one of the best things. Yeah.
Right on. Paw Patrol's on. So if you don't mind, I'm going to...
This is super important. All right.
Going to dive right into it.
Yeah, go for it. All right. Thanks for your time. I enjoy your work.
Yeah, thank you. Take care.
Cool. You too. Bye. Stephen Robbins, immigration lawyer, host of the podcast Redirect: Immigration Law and Perspectives. Our Twitter handle is @offbaseline. My personal Twitter handle, NateKCMO. You can also just check out offbaseline.com for all the episodes and links and the occasional blog post. You should check out next week's show. In part, we'll be talking about social mobility and income inequality, and hopefully not a war. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nate Staley. Be well.